Okay, let's get rolling now. Terry Savage, just for a little bit. Terry, how do you sound over there? How are you doing today?
I'm watching the market. The comeback is fading. We're about almost unchanged now on the Dow. So we're still down significantly for the week. The panic is over. A lot of it started, I tried on Monday to explain, and nobody could really understand this. In Japan, they're the big traders, the huge institutions borrowing the Japanese yen to do some complicated trading. And in fact, when the Japanese central bank raised rates, that messed it all up, and there was a panic among the big institutions. That's why it started in Japan. But everybody was talking about, oh, maybe it was the unemployment, maybe it's a recession. It doesn't matter what it was. The panic is over. The VIX, the fear index, has settled down. But it was a warning shot across your bow to take a look at what you own, what's inside your investments, what's in what mutual funds you really have, what's in your 401k or IRA, and decide, is that where you want to be just in case this happens again and goes farther south?
I was asking no one in particular earlier today and yesterday for that matter. So then what's the context? If the free fall has stopped and some of the losses are gained back, in fact, when it was down 1,400, the Dow on Monday, it only closed down 900, only 900.
A thousand. And it's now down 20 points.
You take my point, though, right? That, okay, so that was that thing. So now how has my world changed? How are things different? How are things much worse? Because it was all doom and gloom on Monday. I'm looking for a little context.
Okay, the context is that nothing in the economy changed, and nor was it about to change. There have been lots of signs of recession. We've talked about them on the show going back months and months. So the economy hasn't changed. Interest rates dropped in the free markets and bounced back up a little, but rates are a little bit lower. We didn't have a huge leap up in unemployment numbers. We haven't seen huge announcements of layoffs. Nothing major changed except the psychology. That's what we were talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
So now you have two choices to say, see, I never got around to do anything. That's a good thing. I didn't get around to do anything. I probably would have done the wrong thing, so I'm not even going to think about it. Well, guess what? If you're in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, that's the right attitude. I'm just putting that money in the 401k. I'm not taking it out until I'm like really old, like in my 60s, really, really old, she says. You know. But if you are among those who are saying, wait, I never dreamed I'd have this money in my much money in my IRA, in my retirement account. Oh my goodness, I know I can make it through the rest of my years. You know, when you're in your 60s, you think, well, maybe 20 years. I mean, just the averages. So you think, okay, I could do that with this money. If you ever saw that drop by 25, 35, 45%, you maybe shorten your lifespan because you have a heart attack immediately.
Okay.
So the idea is to, if you're at that stage where this is it, no more is coming in. I'm not saving anymore. I'm not working now. What do I do with it? I want growth. Yes, I love that increase in value, but I also want to sleep at night. This is the moment. This August is usually, historically a choppy month,
right,
in the stock market, but financial planners and brokers are all on vacation. They came back because of this market uproar the first few days of the week. Call the person you depend on now. Have a discussion. What's the exposure here? How much is in stocks?
But you may capture some losses then, right?
Well, inside a retirement plan, which is where most of the big wealth is for the generation that we're talking about, inside, it doesn't matter. Because it's only a mental accounting. When it comes out, it's all taxed as ordinary income. So yeah, you may take some losses, but that's the point is, are you in the position you want to be in going into a fall that will have more economic news and maybe Fed rate cuts and election news and so forth? It's going to be volatile. Or would you, let me say this, number one, if you still haven't taken your required minimum distribution, it should all be in cash inside your IRA now. At least have that in cash. I would have next year's distribution in cash at this point. Hmm. You can figure that out. It should be the same, roughly the same as you took out this year.
Sure.
So but at least that much cash and maybe more. And it's not just what's in your IRA, because that's where you grew your money, in the stock market primarily, in investments. But if you happen to have a whole bunch of chicken money on the side, T-bills or something, then maybe you can afford to have more stocks in your retirement plan.
Terry Savage, terrysavage.com is on the line. for John? About 8 more minutes. I know you got something to say. What is it, Terry?
How did you know that? You could hear my... Okay, I just, during the break, read something that has me smiling. I hear the smile in my voice. Here's the headline on CNBC.
All right.
Warren Buffett now owns more T-bills than the Federal Reserve. Listen to this. The story goes on. Berkshire Hathaway now owns more in Treasury bills than the U.S. Federal Reserve as Warren Buffett builds up his cash fortress to a record level. The Omaha-based conglomerate now holds $234.6 billion in short-term T-bills, while the Fed only has $195.3 billion in T-bills as of July 31st. Okay, you know I've been Terry, queen of T-bills, and everybody's laughed. What is this, the, you know, chicken money? Now I mean, Warren Buffett and I are like buddies now. T-bills, chicken money. If the smartest investor in our era, in our time, is holding a fortress of cash, shouldn't you? I'll answer your questions now.
Well, what about this couple that said, my wife and I are in our mid-60s. We filled out the paperwork to put an additional $8,000 into each Roth. Do you think we would be better off to wait a week or two until the market settles down or go ahead and pull the trigger now?
Well, first of all, no one ever knows from day to day or week to week. You know, I was a founding member, the first woman trader on the floor of the options exchange. If I were such a great day trader, believe me, I'd still be doing that. I'm not a trader. I'm a long-term investor. But on the other hand, when you're making a contribution to an IRA and you've got $8,000 to go in, why on earth wouldn't you put in $1,000 a month on the 2nd or the 9th or the 11th of the month, every month for the next 8 months? I mean, why would we have to make an all or nothing decision? I know I can't be right, and I hate to look back being wrong, so I try never to look back. So the way I solve that problem is just sign up to do it and tell them automatically deduct from your checking account $1,000 on a certain day every month for the next 8 months.
Okay. 312-981-7200. You've got a question for Terry Savage. She can answer them. Hold on, Terry. I got to reach over and grab the pile of questions for Terry Savage. Let me see if I can find one that we can knock out in a relatively short space of time here. By the way, please tell Terry her... never mind that one. Terry, I am interested in using a Roth IRA rollover as my income is too high for Roth contributions, but I can't find clear information. Can I use only post-tax dollars to contribute to the IRA before the rollover, or do I have to contribute pre-tax dollars?
Okay, wait a second. You make a contribution to a Roth IRA when you have earned income, so you can't make any contribution. You can do a conversion from an old IRA, a traditional IRA. Maybe it was your 401k, and then you rolled it into an IRA rollover, and now you want to pay the taxes. You want the money that you have to pay the taxes to be outside of the IRA. If you're trying to do something called a backdoor conversion, I recommend you read Ed Slott's new book. Go on Amazon. It's called The IRA Time Bomb is Growing Faster. If you go to terrysavage.com, look under the podcast. We just posted a great podcast on that complicated subject with Ed Slott, the IRA guru.
What's the IRA time bomb? I mean, is that something I should know about?
We're talking about the fact that it used to be that you could stretch it. You'd leave your IRA to your child, and then they could stretch it out of their lifetime. So now you only have 10 years, and some people don't even have that. So smart strategies for dealing with inherited IRAs or naming beneficiaries, Ed Slott at irahelp.com will let you find an IRA trained advisor to help you do those complicated rollovers. So his website, irahelp.com, his new book, just go on Amazon, Slott, S-L-O-T-T, and you'll see his new book.
The IRA Time Bomb. By the way, just to be clear now, if people can position their money out of equities, this would be the time to put some of that money into T-bills. Is that what you're saying?
Okay, now watch this. I want to make a very clear point here. People wrote in and posted on my blog, I'm going to take my money out of my IRA or my 401k. You do not have to take your money out of your wonderful tax-sheltered retirement account. If you have an IRA, you can always move it into a Treasury-only money market mutual fund, a call right online to Fidelity or Vanguard or wherever your IRA is. If you've got a mutual fund or stock funds and you think you have too much exposure to the market,
yep,
one phone call and it'll get done. In your 401k, you probably don't have a good money market fund. They don't put those in 401ks because people are supposed to grow their money there. There might be a short-term bond fund. And by the way, just if you have a target date mutual fund inside your 401k, millions of Americans do that. They think, well, that's safe. The pros are adjusting it. They're not. Even at your target retirement year, they're more than half of the money is likely to be in the stock market. So either you need to sell some of your target date fund and put it in that safer short-term bond fund, or you need to raise money outside your retirement account in chicken money. You cannot buy T-bills in your IRA unless your firm, Fidelity will do it, or Vanguard has a brokerage division for that manages IRAs.
Understood.
Otherwise, that's something you do on your own.
Less than a minute. Let's see if we can take one call in short order. Jimmy, how can we help you? You're on the air.
Hey, I'm with Vanguard 529 for my son and daughter, and they're all in stocks. How can I move that to T-bills?
Yeah.
Jimmy, I'm so glad you called. This is a really critical point. Just tell me quickly, what year are they in school?
Both going to school in juniors in college.
Right now, if you have a child or grandchild, the 529 is probably invested in an aggressive stock market portfolio to grow the money. If they're a junior or a senior in high school or already in college, there is always going to be a short-term safe money market type option. I would make that call right now and move the 529 money. If your child's already in high school and going to need in the next 4 or 5 years at least half of it to the money market option, because you just don't know and you have a short-term time horizon.
Right. And did you say they're in college now, Jimmy?
Yeah. They're in college.
They're in college now, Terry.
Yeah, so. I would move that. That should already all be, every 529, yeah. Once your child is that age, has a safe option, the short-term safest option, call and do that immediately.
Don't be greedy.
Not because I think the market's crashing, but because you don't know and you need it within a year or two or three.
It's not going to grow that much in the next year. Go ahead and cash in, or that is, put it in a safe.
Don't
place.
Take it out, but put it in the safest investment option inside either the 529 or your IRA. You can do that. That's not complicated. Don't get intimidated. This is the time to have some chicken money. And if you don't believe me, oh, great, believe Warren Buffett.
Yeah, no kidding. Give him a call. All right, Terry, we're out of time. Thank you for your visit. We'll visit longer next week. Stay well.
For sure. Thank you.
Taki Ito is the chief correspondent of Business Insider, has joined us many times before and does again today. Welcome back.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Your story, why Gen Z college students are reneging on their job offers, is kind of surprising. What's the thrust of this?
Sure. I mean, this trend definitely surprised me, too. You typically think of, you know, if you sign an agreement to join a company, you follow through on it. But more and more, especially college students, seem to be reneging on the offers that they accept and end up going to a different employer instead.
And that's, well, let's start with why. Why do they do that? If they had a job they liked, then what, another better offer came along?
Yeah, usually it's, you know, because for college students, there's kind of like there's a pretty long lag time between when they, you know, accept an offer and when they start. So there's all this time to kind of change your mind. And often, you know, employers recruit at different times of the school year. So, you know, you're not done interviewing with all prospective employers before you start accepting the offers. You know, before it was still kind of taboo to go back on an offer that you said yes to, but it just seems that, you know, since companies have been rescinding offers to students as well, and, you know, companies are just resorting to more and more layoffs, students are developing a little bit more of that same, you know, kind of casual, more cutthroat mentality where they're like, you know, companies aren't loyal to us, so why should we be loyal to them?
Yeah, right. My attitude has always been, at least at that point in your life, you need to look out for number one, maybe later in life too. Maybe that is inconvenient for the company, but why should I inconvenience myself even more so? I've got to do what's best for me. Talk about that mentality.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what the students are saying. You know, I think a lot of students still want to be respectful about it, you know. I did hear about some cases where students will ghost an employer altogether. And I think that's still actually pretty rare. But, you know, these college students, they're savvy. They're so much less naive than I was back when I was in college. They know what cutthroat world they're getting into once they graduate. And yeah, you're exactly right. They're looking out for their own interests.
I wonder what disciplines these kids have studied in or are looking for jobs in. I mean, I think there's plenty of college kids out there that would love to have the luxury of trading one job for the other, but they don't have two job offers. Who are these students that have more than one job offer?
Sure. I mean, I don't have the data to back this up, but anecdotally, I have heard that it seems like computer science students are the most comfortable with reneging, where, you know, it seems like that discipline seems to, you know, have the highest reneg rates. And the reason why, I think, is because these students are in, you know, high demand.
Sure.
There's been a big downturn in the tech industry, but still every industry needs software engineers. They need coders. And so as a result, I think these students end up getting more offers than your typical liberal arts student.
Yeah, I don't know how to score this one, to be honest with you. I mean, I suppose the employer could ask the student to sign a contract or give them a signing bonus to incentivize their compliance. But what are employers doing about this? Do they have any recourse?
You know, not really. I mean, even if, you know, an employer were to offer a signing bonus, you know, it's very expensive to go after somebody in small claims court. So most likely the employer would just have to write off that cost if they don't get the money back. I think probably the most effective thing is prevention, right, as with all things. And so recruiters, I think, are getting better about keeping in touch with students throughout the school year, you know, maintaining that level of excitement that the student had when they first signed the offer. I think also just kind of, you know, being empathetic and, you know, listening if a student is considering another offer and being open to negotiating with that student. You know, the starting salary is usually trickier to negotiate, but maybe the student has a little bit of wiggle room on the start date or the location of the job. One thing I heard was that employers are encouraging their new hires to post that they got their job on LinkedIn right away, and so that creates like a little bit of social accountability, right? If you announce to your entire network that you're joining company A in 6 months, and then you end up joining company B, that like makes you look a little bit bad. So employers are definitely becoming craftier, you know, becoming more creative about ways to make sure that their reneg rates stay relatively low.
You said in your article and just now that, well, employers do this to the students, to the hires as well. It's not that they rescind the offer, is it? Are you suggesting that, or that they might lay people off because times are tough? Nobody's job is guaranteed for life. So why should the employer expect that kind of allegiance from even a prospective employee? But which are you talking about? Do they actually rescind offers, or is it just the specter of maybe losing your job down the road?
You know, we heard a lot of cases over the last 2 years in the tech downturn of companies rescinding offers to new hires, including college students. We heard it from companies like Amazon, Coinbase, Meta. There's a logistics startup named Flexport that revoked offers, I think it was like 3 days before these people were set to start. And so, you know, there definitely were a lot of rescinded offers, also delayed start dates over the last 2 years. And I think that made a big difference in the students' minds. They watched their upperclassmen, you know, be devastated over these rescinded offers. And so I think they feel less loyal to prospective employers than before.
One other paragraph here, I'll quote you to you. Universities are trying to fight the new norm, but there isn't much they can do about it. Many MBA programs, which are small enough to keep tabs on individual students, take a hardline approach. The Wharton School, for example, notes the recruiting violation on a renegger's academic transcript and levies fines as high as $20,000. The school that you got your degree from, that you're graduating from, is got some skin in this game, huh? They're actually the one levying the fine on the student if they don't take the job that was offered?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really rare case when a school will, you know, impose a punishment that's like truly consequential like that. I think, you know, these MBA programs can do it because they're really small, so they can keep track of their students. And also, you know, they have, you know, closer relationships with prospective employers.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, they feel like more of a responsibility. At the undergraduate level, I mean, the consequences are very small. You know, you get shut out of the university job site. You get shut out of the career fair. But, you know, you can apply to those same jobs on all these other websites, too. So it's really not that much of a punishment at all.
Yeah.
I think at the undergraduate level, some career centers are rethinking that. They're thinking about ways to, you know, make these consequences bigger because, you know, students are, you know, reneging on these offers because they can get away with it. If it feels like the punishments are greater, then maybe universities can start to crack down.
And maybe the university cares because if students don't honor the commitment, then the employers are going to think less of that school. You're going to get fewer recruiters to come through if more and more kids aren't accepting the offers. Just one last note here.
Yeah, exactly.
One of our listeners texted in, "Hey, John, no one is looking out for you except for you. The company doesn't. They just want the best person for the lowest pay. Your manager doesn't. They only care about themselves. It sucks. I'm starting to look for another job after 5 years," says listener Brian. Brian, you should read this piece in businessinsider.com. Aki Ito, nice to talk to you as always. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, let's get you more business news today. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The company that makes electric vehicles in Illinois is still losing money despite cost-cutting and increased sales. Rivian Automotive had a net loss of nearly $1.5 billion in the second quarter, nearly 21% higher than the loss at this time last year. Second quarter revenue rose by about 3% and sales were up by 9%. Company execs say the company is on the path to profitability, even though it's currently burning through cash. According to the latest earnings report, Rivian is losing about $32,700 per vehicle it delivers. Its R1 vehicle, manufactured in downstate Normal, sells for about $70,000. The law firm Barnes & Thornburg is expanding its downtown Chicago footprint. Crane says the firm has signed a lease extension for 96,000 square feet at 1 North Wacker. It'll reclaim a floor of the building it had previously subleased. Barnes & Thornburg has been in the building since 2002, and this extension pushes the lease through 2036. The development is newsworthy because of the climbing downtown office vacancy rate. This expansion bucks that trend. Barnes & Thornburg has 220 employees, including 135 attorneys. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, thank you, sir. Now it's the business of food, and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you, and I have on the phone Chicago's best baker.
Woohoo!
And she'll tell us who she is and how she won the title after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. On the phone is Chicago's best baker,
Sarah Macreg.
But in her day job,
I'm a physical therapist.
Board certified in practice at the University of Chicago up until last week.
I'm going back to school to get my PhD in physical therapy.
2 weeks ago, Sarah entered the Chicago's Best Baker competition in Uptown.
I had intended to do this last year.
But she was really pregnant.
And my OB laughed at me in my face and said, "No way are you doing this."
But this year, with a toddler in tow, she entered five categories:
cookie, gluten-free, heirloom, and pastry.
And when it came to judging the overall best amateur baker in Chicago?
Somehow I tricked them.
A big surprise to Sarah Mack, as her friends call her.
Win overall wasn't even on my thought process. I'm sort of a half glass empty, and the glass is also a little smudged and maybe cracked a little bit kind of person. So I didn't want to get my hopes up too much.
Well, the judges, all Chicago pros, liked her bakes.
The judges were extremely generous with their comments, saying how they liked the diversity of flavors that I had. They liked that I used a variety of techniques with all my bakes, which I really, really appreciated those comments, especially coming from professionals.
So Sarah, now that you are Chicago's best amateur baker, any interest in going pro?
I love the idea of baking for a job. The one downside, I wish bakers started like in the late morning, early afternoon. I'm just so not a wake up at 3 a.m. type of person. So if the hours were better, I would maybe consider it.
Sarah McRaig, Chicago's best baker.
Woohoo!
On the food calendar, today's National Raspberries and Cream Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Ted Rossman is a senior credit card analyst at Bankrate.com. I saw what you want to say, Ted, and I can't say that I'm real surprised that you're about to say it. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah, thanks for having me.
That is that half of American cardholders now carry credit card debt with no plan to pay it off. That second part's a little surprising, but I'm not surprised to know that half of the people that have credit cards carry a balance. Is that part A, or is it even more than half of the people carry a balance?
It's half of credit card holders that carry debt from month to month. That's up 6 percentage points from the beginning of the year, and it's the highest we've seen since March of 2020. What's perhaps even more significant is that 6 in 10 people with credit card debt have had it for at least a year. And that's up 10 percentage points from 2021. That's where we really talk about this long-term systemic kind of battle against credit card debt. This is one of these things that's easy to get into and hard to get out of, unfortunately.
Yeah, right. So 6 in 10 people have a balance that they've been carrying for more than a year.
That's right, among people with credit card debt. Yeah, so we really want to break that cycle because the minimum payment math is really brutal. The average credit card balance is about $6,200, according to TransUnion, and the average interest rate is about 20.7%. So if you make minimum payments in that scenario, you're going to be in debt for 18 years, and you're going to end up paying about $9,300 in interest. We really want to change that. Pay it all every month if you can. I realize that's easier said than done. But if you need more time, get a 0% balance transfer card. The Wells Fargo Reflect and the Citi Simplicity are two examples that will let you avoid interest for up to 21 months on balance transfers. That's a big tailwind for your debt payoff journey. Another idea could be to work with a reputable nonprofit credit counselor, someone like Money Management International, who can often negotiate something like a 7 or 8% interest rate over 4 or 5 years.
What are my chances if I just call the number on the back of my card to either negotiate some time or just to get a lower rate? I mean, even if I'm not carrying a bag balance, just what are the chances that a phone call will actually get you a lower rate?
There's a good chance you can get a lower rate. I would say probably about an 80% chance you can get a lower rate. The thing is, how much lower? You know, maybe they lower it from 20 to 15% or something like that. I mean, yes, it's something, but it's still high cost debt. The 0% balance transfers tend to be reserved for new customers. It's really a loss leader kind of strategy. They tempt people with this 0% teaser rate, and it can really work to your advantage if you're disciplined about paying it back. The business case, though, is that a lot of people don't. And then when the term ends, then the rate goes way up. So, you know, definitely dare to be different on that. I don't think you would have very good odds of just calling up and asking for a 0% deal from your current issuer. These are almost always reserved for people coming in from rivals. But that's a way to use the competitive market to your advantage.
3 in 5 Americans carry credit card debt for more than a year. That and more from Ted Rossman, senior credit card analyst at Bankrate.com. Out of time today, Ted. Thanks for your help.
No problem. Thank you.